Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. It's a chilly morning here at the Tunbridge World Fair, and we'll continue our political debate season today with the candidates of Attorney General and a local state representative race. But first will be the Attorney General's race, and on deck for us is the Republican candidate for Attorney General, Deborah Bucknum, and the Democratic candidate for Attorney General, T.J. Donovan. I also want to thank Champlain Valley Equipment for sponsoring these debates. We have sent out the rules for the debate ahead of time. My role as moderator is to ask the question and seek clarifications when needed. I will let the candidates decide where and when they need to challenge each other. So let me go over the format for the candidates and for the listening audience. We'll have a two-minute opening statement by each candidate, and then we will alternate who will answer six different questions. At that point, we'll have four other questions that will be shorter in nature, about a minute. We'll have 2 minutes on the first set of six questions. And then two questions each that you will ask each other. 30 seconds for the question, 2 minutes for the answer. If you would keep your question as short as possible, we would appreciate it. Yesterday, some of the questions were as long as some of the answers. So, and then we'll have closing statements. You will have 2 minutes each. We'll have two commercial breaks during this time, about 3 minutes each. So hold on to your seats. Here we go. The opening statement, Ms. Bucknum.
Thank you, Mike. I am running for Vermont Attorney General because I have been in private practice as a trial, as a trial attorney for 37 years in the Northeast Kingdom, representing thousands of individual Vermonters and small businesses. I started out in Hardwick, and Mike and I know each other from the Hardwick days back in the early 80s. I'm running because my clients have been increasingly frustrated by the way Montpelier treats them. You know, a few months ago, the British voted to exit from the European Union, and a commentator said the reason they did that was because they felt that the bureaucrats in Brussels looked down upon them, and they were sick and tired of that. And the same thing's happened in Vermont. Vermonters are sick and tired of Montpelier bureaucrats and bureaucrats from Waterbury looking down on them. So I am running because I want to turn the culture around to use the Attorney General's office as a representative of the people of Vermont and not of special interest, as it has been in the last 20 years, where big out-of-state donors and lobbyists and corporate interests seem to be the favorites in the Attorney General's office. The favorites in our office are going to be the people of Montpelier. The people of Vermont.
Thank you, Ms. Yep. Bucknum. Mr. Donovan?
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me, and thank you to WDEV for hosting this debate. I'm running for Attorney General because it's time for a change in the Attorney General's office after 20 years. The role of the Attorney General is to enforce the law. I think the best way to enforce the law is to give Vermonters the opportunity to comply with the law. Vermonters are smart, they're tough, they're resourceful, they're good people. They want to do the right thing. The Attorney General, as the Chief Law Enforcement Officer, can build that culture of compliance by reaching out to regular, hardworking Vermonters and asking a simple question. What do you need? Whether it's a small business owner who doesn't have a compliance officer, who doesn't have a lawyer on staff, trying to follow the rules and regs from Montpelier. Guess what? We should be saying to them, what do you need to be successful? I want to start a small business resource department in the Attorney General's office in order to help small businesses grow in this state. The best form of public safety is a good job. We need to grow this economy. We need to grow our jobs. And the Attorney General can be a resource and an asset in growing our economy in Vermont. But when we grow our economy, we can't leave any Vermonter behind. We are facing a heroin epidemic in this state that has not peaked, meaning it's going to get worse before it gets better. This is the top priority in this state right now for everybody, and we need all hands on deck. And what we have to do is take a four-prong approach, and I've done this as Chittenden County State's Attorney, the prosecutor of the largest prosecutor of the largest office and the busiest office in the state of Vermont. It's about enforcement, it's about intervention, it's about treatment, and it is about prevention. That's why I'm running for Attorney General. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for your opening statements. Ms. Bucknum, you had just said in your opening statement that you think that bureaucracy is out of control, and you've been a vocal opponent of the Agency of Education decision regarding the recent education law. I would characterize, and maybe you can differently characterize your concern as the overreach of the agency and the State Board of Education. As AG, what would you do to specifically address your concerns with this agency overreach?
Well, the Attorney General's role is to provide legal advice to the state government. And what I would do is I would give legal advice to the Agency of Education in regard to the way they are interpreting Act 46, which I think is incorrect and, in fact, violates, in my opinion, the Common Benefits Clause of the Vermont Constitution. So that's one way we can do it. But the other way is to try to, in addition to work with the agencies, to try to address some of the concerns of the local communities to so that the Agency of Education becomes more responsive to those local communities. What I've seen is an arrogance in that agency that I think we can talk to them about, we can work with them to try to change the attitude and change the culture there.
Mr. Donovan, a response?
Sure. Yeah. The role of the Attorney General, the core function is to defend the state. And so if we're going to challenge Act 46, I'm not sure it should be the Attorney General challenging Act 46, because the Attorney General is going to have to defend the state if that law is challenged. I think Act 46 is a good step forward. I support public education. I support public schools. I support kids having equality in the delivery of those public education services. And the kids that grow up in a community that have public schools, we need to support those public schools because they are the bedrock and the foundation of our strong communities.
The response is only 1 minute. Oh. I'm sorry. But go ahead.
Okay. For kids that don't grow up in communities that don't have public schools, well, they should have school choice, and I don't have a problem with that. But I think a difference that my opponent and I have is that the Attorney General should be defending that law as opposed to challenging it. I don't disagree about being involved earlier with the legislature in crafting the law. The Attorney General should be more engaged with the legislative body in the crafting of the law so these laws do pass constitutional muster.
We're going to come back to that issue, but Mr. Donovan, this is going to be your question. It's going to be 2 minutes and then a minute response as we go. You've indicated as AG you would not support housing Vermont inmates in private prisons out of state, given that a significant number of prisoners, right around 270, are now housed out of state in private prisons. How do you propose to bring these prisoners back to the state without constructing a new prison?
Sure. Mike, the fundamental duty of government is to take care of people who are in their custody, and that includes prisoners. This is a basic duty of government. And when we incarcerate Vermonters, it is the state of Vermont's obligation to do it themselves, not to outsource it to a for-profit private prison that's making money off the backs of incarcerated Vermonters. That's number one. Number two, private prisons don't work. The U.S. Department of Justice just came out with a report saying they're less safe and they have higher rates of recidivism, meaning that, yes, they may be cheaper up front, but they're going to cost us more in the long run. So this is what we should do. Number one, let's audit our current population. There's no need to build new jails in Vermont. We got 250 people out of state. Let's look at the current population in state. Let's look at how many Vermonters are incarcerated for lack of housing, who are held past their minimum sentences because they have not met that threshold of what adequate housing is. Let's invest in transitional housing and support programs like the Dismas House. Number two, let's look at the number of Vermonters who are held in our jails who suffer from mental illness. Our jail system should not be the largest mental health facility in the state, but unfortunately it is. Number three, let's look at the number of Vermonters who are held for what's called violations of probation, who come back on technical violations and are incarcerated. And finally, let's look at compassionate release programs for the sick and the elderly, those inmates that no longer pose a risk to our public safety, who deserve to be released, that's consistent with public safety, consistent with outreach to victims. And let's make sure that when we have a job to do in Vermont, we do it ourselves, and that's taking care of those folks who are vulnerable and in state's custody.
Ms. Bucknum, your response, and I'm going to add on about 20 seconds. You get a minute response. I'm going to add on 20 seconds because we went a little over the last time.
Thanks,
go ahead.
There are, as you've indicated, there are approximately 250, 270 inmates being housed out of state. By my calculations, if those inmates were housed in Vermont, Vermonters would pay approximately $9 million more a year for housing those inmates. Yes, I think it is a good idea to analyze the situation and look at the costs and benefits of keeping these inmates out of state. And as I've said before, I've represented families who have inmates out of state, and it's very hard on them. But just because a prison is for profit doesn't mean that it is not an appropriate place for inmates. And we need to also look at the needs and interests of the Vermont taxpayers, and maybe we need to prioritize those savings by giving by using that money for other programs that will help Vermonters, for example, addicted mothers who need housing. So it needs to be analyzed very carefully.
Thank you. The next question is to Ms. Bucknum. We're alternating between each other. Several AGs in the U.S. are investigating oil companies, in particular ExxonMobil, under the theory they pulled the wool over Americans' eyes by manipulating public opinion against global warming, or at least not acknowledging its existence. First, do you believe in global warming? Second, is it man-made? And third, would you seek a lawsuit against oil companies similar to other AGs in the other states? You have 2 minutes.
When you ask if I believe in global warming, that sounds like you are asking if I have a religious belief in a particular point of view. I don't think that's the way to frame it. The way to frame it is there climate change? Is there scientific evidence for climate change? And is there scientific evidence that indicates that humans are in some way causing that climate change? From what I can see, from what I've read, there is certainly climate change. And from what I can see and what I've read, there is some indication that climate change is caused in some part by human activity. But I think there is insufficient scientific evidence to indicate that it is the crisis that some people say it is, so that it will change our entire way of life. Now, in regard to ExxonMobil, My understanding of that lawsuit is that ExxonMobil has taken the position for the last nearly 10 years, if not longer, that climate change is an issue. And so what the attorneys general have been looking at is what their position was prior to their present position. It seems to me that that kind of lawsuit is a waste of taxpayers' money, and I would not be in favor of it at all.
TJ Donovan, you have 1 minute for response.
Sure, thank you. I disagree with my opponent on this. I think climate change is real, and I think it's man-made, and I think it is a crisis. And I think we need to do everything we possibly can to address it, because it is changing our lives in every possible way, and it is a crisis not only in this state, but across this nation and this world. Look at Hurricane Irene. Look at Katrina. Look at all the issues that are going on in terms of coastline erosions. Now, regarding the potential lawsuit against ExxonMobil, my understanding is that currently the state of New York and Massachusetts have a lawsuit against ExxonMobil, and Vermont is not a party to that. And I think if elected attorney general, I would certainly monitor that development. I think what we have to be aware of in these lawsuits is, and I think we've seen this before, is Vermont should not go it alone. We are a small state, and we can take on significant risk. And I've run out of time.
Oh, actually, just keep the microphone there. Mr. Donovan, a recent report discovered that Vermont police may not be colorblind when performing traffic stops. Are Vermont police colorblind in who they stop or question? And if not, what would you do to address this issue?
Sure. Racial profiling and the racial disparities in the criminal justice system are real. It's not just the police, though, Mike. It happens in the criminal court system as well. The Vermont general population is made up of maybe 2% people of color, but our corrections population has about 10% of people of color. And really, our incarcerated population should be a reflection of our general population, but it's not. And that says to me that this is a real issue. And I think what we have to address from police, from prosecutors to judges, is understanding that racism exists. You have to be educated and be trained on the issue of unconscious bias that goes on. And we have to do what I think a lot of police departments are doing, frankly, the Vermont State Police, that's doing a good job, the Burlington Police Department, South Burlington UVM, which is to collect data on stops. Terrible case out of Bennington. Fellow African-American stopped in a taxi cab because, quote, he looked like a drug dealer. He's an African-American guy. And he was sentenced up to 10 years for prison. And we got to follow the rule of law here. Reasonable suspicion matters. Probable cause matters. As a prosecutor, I know this issue well. It's been my job for the last 10 years as state's attorney in Chittenden County. The Vermont Supreme Court overruled that case unanimously and sent it back, saying that punishment and the stop were unconstitutional. And at the core issue is the integrity of the criminal justice system, that no matter who you are, no matter what you look like, no matter where you're from, you're going to be treated fairly, you're going to be treated with respect, and the rule of law is going to be followed. So we have to work consistently and constantly on the issue of race in the criminal justice system.
Ms. Bucknum, a one-minute response.
Yes, I agree with TJ that we have to follow the rule of law. We have to follow the rules that allow stops only on reasonable suspicion, on probable cause. That we agree with that 100%. And I think not just racial discrimination, but actually in Vermont there's seems to be selective prosecution of people who are small business people, whereas the larger businesses who have some connections with some of the government officials perhaps get a little better treatment. So there is discrimination everywhere. I mean, the EB-5 program is a prime example of that, whereby Jay Peek and Burke Mountain, their wrongdoing was ignored. So, yes, we're all human and we discriminate.
Ms. Putnam, keep the microphone. What I'm going to ask you is, Vermont has made several attempts to limit campaign financing that ultimately was shot down by the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you see a need for more campaign finance laws? And given our track record, which isn't all that admirable before the U.S. Supreme Court on several issues, how would you advise legislators to proceed with these laws that you might feel are not going to be upheld by federal courts?
Well, I do think there's campaign finance is something that we need to look at. I think part of the problem is the focus has been on the contributors to campaign finance, which leaves in place a incumbents who have a huge advantage over people who are challenging them. So one of the things that I think we should look at very seriously is the campaign finance laws, which allow people with a war chest to use those funds to give donations to other candidates, and who can use those funds to fund their next campaign. Senator Leahy is a prime example. He has $6 million in his campaign war chest. Does he need $6 million to run a Senate campaign here in Vermont? He had that money prior to even knowing he had an opponent.
Before you run out of time, I just want to let you get to the issue of how would you advise legislators about passing legislation that would end up in federal courts where you don't think it would survive?
Well, of course, as TJ has said earlier, yes, we need to play a role in the legislature in regard to laws that are being debated, bills that are being debated in the legislature, and let the legislators know whether we think we have an opinion as to whether this will pass constitutional muster. Absolutely.
TJ, 1 minute. TJ Donovan, 1 minute response.
Thank you. We need campaign finance reform, period. And the first thing we should do is overturn Citizens United. And that's why this presidential race is so important, because it's about the appointment of that fifth Supreme Court justice who hopefully will overturn Citizens United. What we need to do in this state is require more disclosures. Here's the thing, and Deb and I agree on this. Vermonters are smart. They get it. They can make their own decisions. All we got to do is give them information. So when we're talking about money in politics, require disclosures. When you have super PACs coming into this state and nobody knows where the money is coming from, and Mike, here's the thing. I had a super PAC come in my race a few years ago. 4 years later, I still can't tell you where the money came from and who gave it or why. Just make disclosures mandatory. Put the information out there. And then let Vermonters, the voters, decide whether or not this is a good thing or a bad thing. But disclosures is the first thing we should be doing in terms of campaign finance.
When we come back, I want to turn to EB-5 emails, and we'll discuss this. We're having a debate here at the Tunbridge Fair between the Attorney General candidates, Deborah Putnam, who is the Republican candidate for Attorney General, and T.J. Donovan, who is the Democratic candidate for Attorney General. When we come back, we'll turn our attention to EB-5 and emails. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith, and we're broadcasting live from the Tunbridge World's Fair on this chilly morning. Everybody's trying to get their hands warm here during the break. It's political debate season, and today's debate is between the two candidates for Attorney General. That is Deborah Putnam, the Republican candidate for Attorney General, and T.J. Donovan, the Democratic candidate for Attorney General. And I do want to thank our sponsor, Champlain Valley Equipment, for sponsoring this debate. So let's go to a little bit more rapid format, a minute for each of you on these particular questions. TJ, we'll start out with you. Bill Sorrell has sequestered most emails, particularly emails between the governor's office and JP personnel pertaining to EB-5. Would you handle the email disclosure differently? A minute.
Mike, I believe in transparency, and this is a core issue of government in terms of maintaining and promoting public trust. And the public records law, I think, is very clear that it errs on the side of disclosure. There are certain exceptions, one of being if a case is under investigation. Obviously, as a criminal prosecutor, we have many requests for public records, and we turn them over when we can. There's many times when we say no, though, because the integrity of the investigation is at stake. And that case, my understanding of the EB-5 case right now, it's an ongoing investigation within the Attorney General's office. If those emails constitute evidence, they probably should be withheld for the time if they're going to jeopardize the integrity of the investigation. And so I believe in disclosure, I believe in transparency, but you got to let prosecutors and investigators do their job first.
Ms. Bucknam.
Well, I agree with that, but Vermont's public records laws should be improved where we get a D or an F from the Good Government Association regarding our public records laws. And there's too often the government just stonewalls, Vermont state government just stonewalls people who are asking for public records when there isn't the exception that that the investigative exception that is in the law. So we need to actually look at the public records law and make sure the agencies are complying with it.
Keep the microphone because the question's coming right to you. A minute for this. Do you support any further gun control?
No.
TJ, response?
This is an area of disagreement. I do support universal background checks. Here's the thing. Vermonters have to go through a test to drive a car. I don't think it's an infringement on anybody's right to do a background check on somebody who is going to possess a firearm. I believe in responsible gun ownership, but I think we've also seen cases as a prosecutor, people who, frankly, have lost their privilege to own a gun, people who are severely mentally ill, people who are violent and dangerous, violent criminals and felons. They shouldn't have a gun. Now, when you look at the number of homicides in our state, you have to look at domestic violence, and many of those homicides are related to domestic violence. So when you have that cooling down period, which that background check provides for, I think it's going to save lives. I think that universal background check is a good thing.
I'm going to give you a little bit more time because you said no, and then that was it.
Thank
so,
you.
About 30 seconds.
All right. I disagree. Vermont has one of the lowest violent crime rates in the world. Vermont state government has become increasingly punitive. We don't need another layer of regulations regarding guns that would affect law-abiding Vermont citizens. So I disagree with TJ on that.
TJ, this is TJ Donovan. This is coming to you. TJ Donovan is the Democrat candidate for Attorney General. And Deborah Bucknam is the Republican candidate for Attorney General. And we're talking about various issues that deal with the Office of Attorney General. TJ Donovan, do you support the legalization of the selling of marijuana?
Not at this time. I think we should go slow on this. I support decriminalization of marijuana. I think that was a good thing. Here's why. Many people who went through the criminal justice system, often the poor, were treated differently. And with that conviction, you lost your eligibility for federal student loans, thereby forfeiting your chances of going to college. I support medical marijuana. People who are in pain and are suffering should deserve access to anything that relieves their pain. But on the legalization of marijuana, I think we need to go slow. I think the Vermont legislature did the right thing by not passing it this year. Here's my position. We need anybody who has a drink at night and is going to get behind the wheel of a car should be thinking about that 0.08 standard. That enhances our public safety. We need the same for marijuana. We also need a roadside test, just like for alcohol. We don't have those things. I don't care what people do in the privacy of their homes or their bedrooms, but when we're talking about public safety, we're talking about roads, and we need to make sure that comes first.
Ms. Bucknam, your response.
Yes, I agree. We should not be passing legalization of marijuana for a variety of reasons. I've spoken to a lot of drug and alcohol counselors in the course of this campaign and in my practice, and they are unanimous. They say that we should not legalize marijuana because it gives the wrong message to people who are struggling with addiction. And besides, this would be another lawsuit that would go probably to the Supreme Court, and we'd lose. This is a federal issue. A tiny little state of Vermont should not be regulating a drug that really has never been tested. It would be very, very difficult to regulate this drug. And so I strongly agree that we should not be passing legalization.
Ms. Bucknum, do Black Lives Matter or do All Lives Matter?
All Lives Matter. I think we live under the rule of law. We have a Declaration of Independence that says all men are created by their Creator and are created equal by our Creator, and that's the American way. So I believe that all lives matter.
T.J. Donovan, your response?
You know, Black Lives Matter. And I'll relate a story. I was talking to a African-American gentleman who was in Ferguson. And I asked the same question, Mike, to him. I said, why aren't we saying all lives matter? And he looked at me and he said, if they did, we wouldn't be having this conversation. And I think that you can't discount the African-American experience in America. When you look at the number of people of color who are incarcerated, number of people who have been warehoused, and look no more than our sentencing policy on the issue of crack cocaine and cocaine. The same drug, but the view is different on who uses it. And crack cocaine, which is stereotypically referred to as an African-American drug, carries a much more punitive sentence under our federal sentencing guidelines, more so than cocaine, which is considered stereotypically a white person drug. So Black Lives Matter do matter, and this gets to the integrity of our criminal justice system.
TJ, why don't you just hold the microphone there for a minute? The Syrian refugee resettlement issue in Rutland has been divisive, to say the least. What should be the role of the AG's office in the area of refugee resettlement, if any?
Yeah. I support refugee resettlement, and I support the Syrians coming to the state of Vermont, whether it be in the city of Rutland or whether it be in the city of Burlington. You know, I grew up in Burlington, and I live in South Burlington now, and the cities of Burlington and Winooski have been, I think, greatly enhanced by new Americans who came through the refugee resettlement program. And so I think the role of the Attorney General is to work with local communities, to be a liaison, as Deb and I have talked before, about being more engaged with Vermonters, whether it be at a local level, on these issues, to answer the legal questions, whatever they may be. We are a nation of immigrants, and we all have come to this country one way or another. The only question is, how far back do you got to go? My grandparents were Irish immigrants. And for me, we got to pay it forward and give people an opportunity to come to this country and realize the American dream. I support Syrians coming to this country.
Ms. Bucknum.
Yes, I agree. We're a nation of immigrants, and we should welcome immigrants. However, I think the issue in Rutland is the issue of local citizens having a voice in this particular program, and it is the frustration of Vermonters that they seem to be looked down upon, as I've indicated initially. And that their voice doesn't matter, their opinions don't matter. I don't think the people of Rutland are against bringing immigrants into their city. They are concerned about who these immigrants are and whether they've been properly vetted. And I think their voice should be listened to rather than just in this program imposed on them.
When we come back, we're speaking with the Attorney General candidates, both Republican candidate for Attorney General Deborah Bucknum and Democratic candidate for Attorney General T.J. Donovan. When we come back, we're going to ask each of you to ask a question to the other. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to WDEV's Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're broadcasting live from the Tunbridge World's Fair. Chilly evening. The sun is coming out, breaking through the fog, and it's nice. What a nice day we're going to have. We're doing debates for the last 2 days. We have governor and lieutenant governor. Yesterday, we have AG, attorney general, and a local state representative race today. We're in the midst of an attorney general's debate with T.J. Donovan, who is the Democratic candidate for attorney general, and Deborah Bucknum, who is the Republican candidate for attorney general. And we're at the point where each of you get to ask each other a question. So, Deborah, you're up first to ask T.J. Donovan a question.
Thank you, Mike. T.J., I know you have a lot of out-of-state donors, and you also have a donation from David Blinderstorff. David Blinderstorff believes that we should put industrial wind towers on all our ridge lines. Do you believe that Montpelier should be making the determination as to whether we should have wind towers on our ridge lines, or should local communities be making that decision?
You have 2 minutes, Mr. Donovan.
Thanks for the question, Deb. I think what the legislature did and Governor Shumlin coming back into the veto session was the right approach to wind development in this state. And that compromise position really, I thought, balanced the rights of the local communities as well as the utility of renewable energy. I support renewable energy. I support the goal of the state of Vermont to get to 90% renewable energy by 2050. And my understanding of the compromise that came out of that veto session this past summer was this, that towns do have a say, that they can plan accordingly in their town planning about whether or not, number one, they want wind development. Number two, if so, where in that local town should it be placed? And when it goes through the process, the regulatory process, through the Public Service Board, that town plan would be giving, I think the legal term is substantial deference. Now, I think you and I both know as lawyers, I'm sure that term is going to be argued over what substantial deference is. But I don't think towns should have a veto power over the development of wind. And you have to look no further about whether it's any other public good, whether it was the interstate, for example, that modernized this state. And if towns were given a veto power over the interstate, Vermont, I think, would look very different. And so I think that issue that was addressed in June of this year in Montpelier in the veto session, which gave towns that substantial deference and told them to ask them to plan, but at the same time did not give them the veto power, was a good compromise.
T.J. Donovan, it's your turn to ask Deborah Bucknum a question. You have 30 seconds. She has 2 minutes to respond. Okay.
Deb, you and I both agree that the heroin epidemic is the number one crisis in this state. And as you know, I've been a big supporter of the availability of Narcan, that reversal drug for people who are suffering from a heroin overdose. And in Burlington alone, in the last 2.5 years, over 700 people's lives were saved as a result of Narcan being available. My question to you, Deb, is do you support the increased availability of Narcan, and should all first responders and police officers be carrying Narcan?
Thank you. I believe that we should use every tool we can to save people's lives. I think the issue with Narcan is this. that there are some first responders and some police officers who feel that they are not equipped to administer this drug and are concerned about administering it improperly. So we need to talk to law enforcement and to first responders about the protocols and about what they need in order to be able to administer this drug properly. I think the other problem that has come up that I've heard from law enforcement is that Narcan is that the people who are suffering from opioid dependency have Narcan themselves, and so they have it in order to, if they overdose, that they can administer it themselves. That is a potential problem because that, again, it seems to give the message that if you have a drug that can prevent you, when you have an overdose, from preventing you from being seriously injured or dying, then it's okay to use these drugs if you use them, quote unquote, safely, as the Department of Health warned several weeks ago. And so, number one, yes, I think the first responders and the police should be able to use these, but I think we need to speak with them about how they want to use them most effectively. But we also have to be careful about these drugs becoming street drugs.
Now we go to the closing statement, because Ms. Buckton, you were the one that started out. We'll start with T.J. Donovan for a closing statement. You have 2 minutes each for a closing statement. You're at it.
Well, Mike, thanks again for having us here, and I want to thank Deb for engaging in this debate. I think this is our third debate, and I think we both would agree that this is a worthwhile exercise in democracy. So, again, thank you for having us. And with the sun coming out, we are warming up a little bit. And, you know, throughout this debate, I think the listeners heard some differences. For me, what I want people to know is this. I'm running for Attorney General because I believe in Vermonters. I believe in giving Vermonters the opportunity for success, whatever that may mean, whether it's that small business owner who has a question about a rule or regulation and wants to grow his business. I want them to call the Attorney General's office so we can answer that question for them. Whether it's that person who's struggling with addiction, who needs to get into treatment, I'm going to be an Attorney General who advocates for treatment on demand. At the same time, I'm going to be an Attorney General who's tough on drug dealers who sell drugs for greed or for profit. They deserve to go to jail. I'm going to be Attorney General that protects the unique landscape of Vermont. Our landscape, our environment is our greatest asset in this state. And as an Attorney General, I'm not only going to promote it, I'm going to protect it. I'm also going to make sure that we protect the Vermont taxpayer by making sure that the programs that we have, that people who are not being ripped off from large corporations and scammers and fraudsters, I'm going to protect the most vulnerable, whether it's the children or whether it's elderly Vermonters who are being financially exploited. I'm going to stand up for people in the criminal justice system that I've done my entire career, protect victims of crime, but at the same time reform our criminal justice system so we have a consistent system throughout our 14 counties where everybody has equal access to justice. And we're going to make sure that we invest in restorative justice in this state, because it is about unity, freedom, mercy, and justice in the finest traditions of the state of Vermont. That's why I'm running for Attorney General.
Ms. Bucknell, your closing statement.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, TJ. Again, I think we've had some vigorous but civil debates. I'm running for Attorney General because I want to bring the values of small business, which I've owned for 30 years, and the values of the Northeast Kingdom into the Attorney General's office. For too long, the Attorney General's office and state government has been playing favorites with special interests, with big donors and corporate interests. And we need to turn the Attorney General's office back to being a servant of the people. I have two, we haven't had a chance to talk about this much, I have two major initiatives that I plan to institute when I am Attorney General. One is the opioid epidemic. We've put out a 7-point program in which we want to use the Attorney General's office as a leadership in not only helping to treat people who are suffering, but to prevent the spread of the disease. The disease continues to spread even though we focused on this disease for the last 2 or 3 years. And prevention includes more vigorous law enforcement, more consistent law enforcement, and cooperation amongst the law enforcement agencies. And the second thing we're going to propose, we have proposed, is the Citizens Small Business Protection Unit, which will go beyond what TJ is suggesting in answering questions, and we're going to be an advocate for the Vermonter who is not getting the service they need from the government.
Thank you, Deb Buckman. Thank you both for being here. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back with more debates in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're broadcasting live from the Tunbridge World's Fair, and it's political debate season. Today's debates will be between the candidates of Attorney General and a local state representative race. We just had our debate with the Attorney General candidates, and now coming up at 10:15, we'll have two candidates, David Ainsworth and Sarah Buxton, talking about local issues and debating their race, who goes to Montpelier as their state representative from this area. And now I want to turn our attention for the next few minutes on national issues. And on the line with us is Justin. Justin, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here.
Justin, Tom, I can just barely hear him. Can you just boost it up a little bit? Thanks. Hey, Justin, this is Justin Ducknam. Justin, Hillary's health, is she back to good health now?
You know, it looks like that. She was back on the campaign trail yesterday after a bit of an absence following the situation at the 9/11 memorial. She was saying she felt much better. Her campaign said that she felt much better. And she actually took the stage with James Brown's I Feel Good playing in the background, which I guess was their sort of not-so-subtle nod at that. So she appeared yesterday, said essentially that she's recalibrated her campaign, wants it to be less of an election about voting against somebody, this person being Trump in this situation, and more of voting for the candidate. So that's a bit of a shift and a bit of a change of a strategy, which was to largely lie low after receiving a pretty unprecedented convention bounce.
Donald Trump has gotten tangled all up again in this birther controversy. How did this happen?
This was interesting. You know, he's been refusing to bring this issue up when asked about it. He's been dodging it for a while now. Hillary Clinton actually brought it back into a conversation amid Trump's outreach to African-American voters when he was essentially telling them, what do you have to lose by voting for me? Clinton reminded everybody that this was the candidate who questioned the eligibility of the first black president. So that was a pretty good way to bring it back in here. Yesterday, he was asked by the Washington Post what he felt about this. He said he wasn't going to talk about it until the time was right, but apparently Trump's campaign disagreed, likely due to the mini firestorm that comment set off and the mounting questions. They released a statement saying that Trump now, in fact, does believe that Obama was born in the U.S., so a pretty big reversal and one of those phrases that you just never thought you'd say sometime if you were talking about this race last year.
This seems like a campaign that does not want to get distracted with these kind of issues as it sort of is closing in, and it is closing in various battleground states, closing in or beating Hillary Clinton. Is that is that the strategy? Go for economic, national security issues, stay away from the controversial issues that has tripped him up in the past?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the campaign is saying. They actually made that statement in the prepared statement that they released last night, saying that this is going to be a race where Trump is going to focus on defeating radical Islamic terrorism, in their words, saying that it's going to be focused on the economy, job growth, and whatnot, and of course, making America great again. So this looks like a kind of newly restrained Trump, a Trump who's not going to be attacking Gold Star families like he did in the days after the convention. Whether or not he'll be able to maintain that remains to be seen. But it looks like there is an almost superhuman effort going on behind the scenes to, keep him tamped down. The fact that we did not see an immediate tweet after the 9/11 ceremony, blasting Hillary Clinton is probably a sign that, at least some people within the campaign are now willing to take away Donald Trump's phone for periods of time, which is a much different candidate than we've seen in the recent, months.
Colin Powell wishes that his emails were his emails instead of the world's now. He does not seem to like either candidate by his emails that have been hacked and shown to the world now.
Oh, absolutely not. No, he said that he considers Hillary Clinton a friend, applauded her for being an ambitious person and whatnot, but then said that he had some discussions behind the scenes warning Clinton staff not to, point to him or to throw him under the bus, as the private email server issue was coming up. He also made some kind of uncouth remarks to a colleague about Bill Clinton's love life, which was kind of floating around Twitter quite a bit. But then when it came to Donald Trump, he took a much more aggressive tone, essentially saying that this was somebody who was a disgrace to the U.S. Advising reporters not to get him too much oxygen, saying that he'll likely tear himself down all by himself. But it certainly does not seem like he's a fan of Donald Trump in any sense of the word, nor can he really point to too many people, within his sort of area of expertise or his world who would be, supportive of Donald Trump either.
Justin, I've got about a minute, but one of the things that I'm seeing more and more in the newspapers, especially the national newspapers, is Trump could win this, couldn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what it's looking like right now. This race has been getting a lot tighter, especially with the, four-way race of this, the two third-party candidates. It becomes a much, closer race. If you factor those in, according to a CBS New York Times poll that was released yesterday, it is a actual tie between Clinton and Trump. If you take them out and have it be a forced two-way race, then you see Clinton leading by, just about 2 or 3 points. And that is something that, will probably be getting more attention. The fact that, Gary Johnson or Jill Stein could actually be spoilers, particularly because about 36% of millennials who were polled yesterday actually said that they preferred one of the, third-party candidates to either Trump or Clinton.
Justin Duckham from Talk Media News, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Justin Duckham from Talk Media News. Coming up, our debates at the local level, at the state representative level, with David Ainsworth and Sarah Buxton. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're back at the Tunbridge World's Fair, and it's debate season. It's political debate season here. We've spoken with the candidates for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and now we're going to turn our attention more locally to a state representative race, and in the race for state representative for this area, the Tunbridge area, where we're sitting right now, is the candidates David Ainsworth and Sarah Buxton. We've gone over the rules ahead of time, so you pretty much know what's coming to you. I'll try to guide you through this. I just want you to know that my role as a moderator is to ask the questions, seek clarifications when needed. I will let you decide whether you want to challenge your opponent or not. Don't leave it up to me, because I won't do it. It will be your responsibility of what if you want to challenge your opponent or not. I do want to thank Champlain Valley Equipment for sponsoring these debates. The weather is starting to get a lot better than it was this morning when it was very, very chilly. But what will start now with this state representative race is opening statements, and each of you have 2 minutes, and Mr. Ainsworth, you are first.
Thank you, Mike, and welcome to the fair. As a former lieutenant governor once said, the grandest little fair in the world, and ever since then been known as the World's Fair. Yes, I'm running again for office. First of all, I feel that every race should have an opponent, and I'm certainly not afraid of running against Sarah. Obviously, here it'll be our fourth time, I think, running against each other. And I feel I bring a local touch to the representation. Vermont needs to have representatives up there to clarify things for the almighty that live in Montpelier and rule down upon us. Unfortunately, I don't think that should be the way it is. It should be the people telling the individuals up there what needs to be done and not the other way around. I feel I have a lot of life experience living on a farm, working in the farm, trying to pay the bills from the farm, which has not been very easy. And I understand that sometimes you have to make the tough decisions. Yes, we want to have growth. We want to have lots of things, but we need to have it affordable. And right now, Vermont is not affordable. Many, many times, I think the number, I don't remember the exact number, but a large number of 20 to 40-year-olds have been leaving. That possibly is part of the cause of reason why we got a drop in students at the education system, because the young families that would normally be here are moving away because it's easier to live other places, less expensive. And I think that's a sin. I've got two granddaughters that I'm hoping sometime will be able to, when they grow up, be able to live here and stay in Vermont. But right now, it's highly questionable because it just opportunities aren't there.
Thank you, Mr. Ainsworth. Sarah Buxton, you have 2 minutes for your opening statement.
Great. Thanks very much, Mike, and to WDEV for hosting this debate. I'm Sarah Buxton, and I'm running for state representative because I believe that in Vermont, if you work hard and do your part, you and your family should be able to get ahead and stay ahead. I'm proud of the progress we've made since I've been in office, but we can't claim mission accomplished yet because there's more work to do. Let me give you a few examples.
Go right ahead.
First.
This is the Tunbridge Fair. You've got to go through this.
So since I first took office, Vermont has become the top state in the country in the percentage of people who have health insurance. Yet for many, including myself, it's still too expensive to actually use it. Another example, over 100 jobs have been created in this district since I was elected. These are good paying jobs at places like GW Plastics, and yes, they're available right now. Yet many of the job seekers in our region don't have the necessary qualifications to land those jobs. We have more work to do to bridge that gap in workforce training and in college completion. Another example, since passing Act 46, the education tax rate in Tunbridge has dropped 4 cents. But the pressure on our school budget remains, the needs of our students persist, and my neighbors still say their property taxes are too high. We've got more work to do. Finally, last session, the legislature invested an additional $1 million to help lower the cost of childcare, especially for low-income working families. But that investment only bumped us up to the recommended support rate for 2010. We need to do more. I'm asking the folks in Royalton and Tunbridge to re-elect me because I'm representing you well. I'm a problem solver and a pragmatist. I understand the complexities of our district and how to meet your needs. I'm humbly asking for the opportunity to keep doing this and getting the results that matter.
Mr. Ainsworth, your first question. Your opponent, Ms. Buxton, sat on the House Education Committee last year. Is there something specifically that you would either criticize or credit her for in her work in the committee, or is there something you would have pushed as a member of that committee?
Yes, I do have something I have to criticize her on. She has apparently, in testimony within her committee, said she was very disappointed in the residents of Tunbridge because they were shirking their responsibility for being concerned about the children's education by wanting to be a choice town and not being able to vote upon the budget. of when their children go away to another school outside of the Tunbridge area or South Royalton or any town outside of Tunbridge. And myself, I think they're showing a very great deal of responsibility. They're actually sitting down and choosing where to send their children. At the same time as she's criticizing her constituents for wanting to be a choice town, she goes ahead and passes a special bill allowing another neighboring town, which she is not a representative of, but of course trying to help out another town by allowing them to go beyond what the law says they should be going to their giving to their children to support the education, to helping out the families that choose to send their children somewhere else other than the school that they had as a town chosen to be the designated high school, because the Stratford town only has 1 through 8. So apparently sometimes she shows favoritism and sometimes she doesn't, and I'm a little concerned about that. I think choice should be allowed. The individual parents are making well thought out decisions on deciding where to send the children, and in fact when Act 46 was passed, the consent agreement was within the legislature to have caps on amount of raising of taxes, and the school choice was not being cut. And in fact, that within 9 months, they did renege on both things.
Ms. Buxton, your response to that. You got a minute.
Okay, thanks. So first, the primary accusation there is fabricated. It's completely incorrect. I would never criticize my community for the choices that it's making, that is lawfully permitted to do. And in fact, to underscore my support for our community's choice, I was the one that fought very, very hard to ensure that protections for choice towns were included in Act 46. So there is no basis to that accusation. I believe that what we did with Act 46 was brave. I think it was long overdue, and I think it's beginning to give us the results that we, as a state, so desperately need. Already, we're starting to see that substantial equity and the quality and the variety of educational opportunities is expanding across districts that are moving forward. We're seeing operational efficiencies that are much better and much stronger, and I look forward to continuing to work to strengthen Act 46.
Ms. Buxton, you, given that your opponent, Mr. Ainsworth, had previously served on the House Agriculture Committee, we're sitting here at the Tunbridge Fair, which is agricultural-based, is there something specifically that you would either criticize or credit Mr. Ainsworth for his previous work on that committee, or is there something that you would have pushed as a member of that committee?
Sure. So we've seen a lot of change in the agricultural policy of the state. Oh, I think this
is
head raise is just for me, right? I think we've seen a lot of change, and I think that some of that change was rooted in the time when David was serving on the agricultural committee. Some of the important things that they did at that point was start the movement towards supporting organic and homestead farming with some initial on-farm slaughter laws and some permissive action around selling raw milk. I think we could have started sooner in trying to bolster our agritourism. And that comes right in the Agriculture Committee when we look at the value-added products and the way in which our farmers and our other land use, our other folks who are using land here in this community can add value to the economy. We've done a lot of that work moving forward with the Land Enterprise Bill since 2010, but we certainly could have started doing some of that sooner.
Mr. Ainsworth, a response?
I'm afraid I have a little bit of a problem. I don't mind somebody using or selling raw milk. The fact is, up until I had the surgery this winter, I commonly always drank milk out of my own tank. Unfortunately, now with my immune system compromised, I have to buy store milk, which pains me more than probably the surgery did. However, they want to be able to not be inspected and just go ahead and sell wherever they want, take it to farmers markets and leave it sitting in their cooler with questionable whether to stay under the 40-degree temperature required, and then go do some other shopping. So, yes, I have some real concerns about it. We asked in the committee about people about liability of it, and they said, well, I'm not worried about that because they can have my cows if they want, but I don't have anything else. I'm renting a land or I don't own this, so I'm not worried about it. And I'm afraid that has an effect on the whole agricultural industry.
When we come back, I'm going to switch to the economy and have a couple of questions on the Vermont economy. Mr. Ainsworth, you brought up affordability. I want to sort of follow up on that. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith, and we're broadcasting live from the Tunbridge Fair, and we're in the middle of a state representative debate between David Ainsworth and Sarah Buxton here at the Tunbridge Fair, the local rep race here in this area. And I do want to thank Champlain Valley Equipment for sponsoring this debate today. The sun is out. It's bright. It's warming up. Thank you that it is, in fact, warming up. So let's get back. We're going to pick up the pace now a little bit. You'll have a minute to respond, a minute for rebuttals. We're going to talk about the economy here. Polls show that when you talk about economic issues, for example, the Vermont economy, jobs, state spending, nearly 50% of Vermonters see this as the number one issue. From your perspective, is it the number one issue? And number two, what would you do to specifically allay these concerns of Vermonters? Mr. Ainsworth.
Yes, I do believe it's a very important. I think with the $500 million that they have raised in taxes and fees over the past 6 years of the Shumlin administration, people are just not seeing that they're getting ahead. You can take the polls and make them show, or the surveys and make any figures you come out any way that you want to do it, but people are not feeling it, and they don't have the money. They're having to worry about trying to pay taxes year after year. I mean, one couple just told me the other day they're up to $6,000 in taxes now, and so, you know, they're having to worry about putting away almost $500 to $600 every month just to be anticipating paying taxes at the end of the year. Unfortunately, with a single party running things, there's no discussion, no alternatives. It's our way or out the door, and unfortunately, we need to have that ability to have discussion across the lines.
Sarah, you have 1 minute.
Thanks. This is a really important question. There is a proven way to support growth in our economy, and that is to get the people in our communities employed at good paying jobs. What we've done over the last 6 years, at least here in the district and I believe across the state, is we've created, with the support of the government and in partnership with private businesses, we've created many good paying jobs right here. Now, the people aren't taking those good paying jobs because we have a gap between the workforce skills and the qualifications needed to be able to perform those jobs. And so the next step that we have to take is to make serious investment in workforce training, in retraining, and in college completion. We know that people who have a college degree make substantially more money, and people making more money will help our economy.
Next question is to you, Ms. Buxton. Do you support a single-payer healthcare system, and what would you do with Vermont Health Connect? You've got
sure.
a minute.
So right off the bat, let's just acknowledge that Vermont Health Connect has continued to underperform, and it's been a big disappointment. It's impacted me and many of my other constituents. Right now, though, Vermont Health Connect serves about 16,000 Vermonters and 44,000 small businesses that are purchasing unsubsidized plans. The last session, we began a process of contracting with an independent consultant who perform an analysis of the current functionality and the long-term sustainability of Vermont Health Connect. I'm eager to see what that examination will reveal. I don't think that we're going to find it to be very cost effective to move off the path that we're on, because like it or not, we're still going to have a system to sustain our Medicaid plans and our subsidized plans.
Single payer. I'll give you 15 more seconds. Sure. Single payer, because I'm going to ask the same.
I don't think that it's possible to technically get to single payer in Vermont. I haven't seen a plan that would actually move us all the way to single payer. If we could move to universal access to health care, such as a Medicare for all process, maybe starting with Dr. Dinosaur 2.0, I am in support of that. I think it's the place we need to go.
Mr. Ainsworth, your response: do you support a single payer health care system, and what would you do with Vermont Health Connect?
Well, having never been around with the Vermont Health Connect and not being involved with it, fortunately, my wife has a good health plan, which was crucial this winter when I had a kidney transplant. I must say, I think we're attacking this thing the wrong way. It's like having the tail of the horse and thinking you're going to be able to steer the horse. You got to get the reins on the costs and expenses at the hospital level. And unfortunately, a small state like Vermont is not, we're at the receiving end. We're not leading the way on this, but it has to be done better, probably on the nationwide level. We do need, and we're going to be running into a very serious problem with not enough primary care physicians. I've had six different primary care physicians. In fact, the standing joke in the family is, who's the next one they want to leave in the area? Because every time I get one, they end up leaving within 6 months. So we've got to change our approach to do this. I don't know that Vermont can handle this on their own.
Vermont Health Connect, what would you do with it?
I would probably scrap it and go to the federal system.
Mr. Ainsworth, if you were elected to the legislature, would you support legalizing the selling of marijuana in this state?
No. Marijuana is a drug, period. I do believe, and I have changed my view upon it, it does have some therapeutic ability to help with pain medication with people and keep them off some of these more addictive things. But I do not think it should be a recreational, gee, I feel like lighting up a joint. I don't want somebody driving down the road with a tractor trailer full with logs, smoking a reefer, coming at me. Sorry.
Ms. Buxton, your response: if you were elected, if you were reelected back to the legislature, would you support legalizing the selling of marijuana in this state?
Sure. Like David, I have a great number of reservations about this policy area. I support medical marijuana and the use for symptom relief. I certainly support fully decriminalizing marijuana. And I have not seen a plan yet that puts forth a way of legalizing marijuana that public safety, our principals, our medical health professionals, our mental health professionals can get behind. If that happens, then I think I could really give it some serious consideration, but I'll wait for that time when a proposal has flushed itself out to meet those requirements.
Next question is directed at you. You, Sarah, do you support gun control?
So, let me say first that the Second Amendment is no joke. It's real, and we can't pretend that it isn't. That said, like every other fundamental right guaranteed under the Constitution, the government may place limits on its exercise and the restrictions if it's narrow and serves to advance an important government interest. In this case, I believe that felons, terrorists, domestic abusers, and convicted drug sellers should be barred from buying a gun. Simple as that. I'm not talking about restricting the pistol, hunting rifle, or any other firearm in your closet if you aren't one of those people. We can be smart enough here in Vermont to balance legitimate Second Amendment rights with some minimal preventative measures.
Mr. Ainsworth, the same question to you. Do you support gun control?
I think it's a cause looking for a solution, and I'm not sure that we actually have a problem. I would like all the terrorists in the audience out here, please raise your hand so we can identify you. I'd like all the abusers. Of course nobody wants, and this does happen, but I don't believe you can go out and find, it's kind of like 2014. You might have the ability to maybe think of doing this sometime down the road, so we need to limit you right now. I don't think there's that much of a problem. We have a lot serious more problems to worry about than passing some other laws that might have other consequences we don't know in advance.
Mr. Ainsworth, do you believe in climate change, and is it man-made?
Obviously, everything in nature, there's a cause and effect. And, of course, with the number of growing population, the need of energy and food and whatnot, there's got to be some effect. However, I don't believe Vermont needs to lead the way in this with our minuscule population. I don't think it is something we should be first. It needs to be handled on a national level. It needs to be handled on a world level. But to go ahead and say, hey, we're going to sacrifice and set an example, I'm sorry. I don't think Vermont needs to sacrifice and try to outprice ourselves in the market with our products and everything, because we're green, totally green, and don't have any effect on the environment.
Ms. Buxton, your response.
Yes, I believe in climate change, and yes, I believe it's man-made. I think to deny that and to not take serious steps to try to reverse the impact of climate change right now is to let down the future generations who are depending on us to be good stewards of our environment. There are a number of things that the legislature has done since I've been in office, and I think we've got a lot more work to do. But we certainly can't hide our heads in the sand and believe that things are just going to go away, because it's very clear they're not.
Ms. Buxton, keep the microphone, because I'm going to be asking you this question. Do you believe in the concept of a carbon tax, and would you support the concept if legislation was introduced in the legislature to institute one? I'm just talking about the concept of a carbon tax.
Thanks, because there has been a plan that's been floated that I've seen pieces of, and I don't think I can speak to my support of the plan. I think as it is right now, I wouldn't support the proposal that's out there. The idea that we should pay for our pollution in the same way that we pay for trash disposal makes sense to me. As David mentioned earlier, we have to bring it in the context of what we can afford here in the state and what the scale of the problem is. So I think I could be persuaded to consider some type of a pollution tax, but it would have to be one that is progressive and not regressive, and not rest on the backs and pocketbooks of the lowest income Vermonters.
Mr. Ainsworth, your response to that question.
Again, I don't think Vermont should be the first, but a lot of people up there think we've got to be first in everything. I don't think we should be first in having a carbon tax. We do need to consider alternatives down the road. There is not an infinite supply of petroleum products. Even though they can come up with new technologies to vastly improve them. And that's the reason why we have such low prices on our fuel right now. But I just don't think we should be stepping out to do this. It's going to hinder, again, all the sales of our products we're trying to boast and sell if we're going to be the high-priced item on the market. I mean, Vermont pride and the Vermont culture only goes so far. The Cabot Co-op that I work with realizes that the name of Vermont and New England in New England area is significant, but once you get down out of the region, it does not have the same value effect it does here in the Northeast.
In this area, keep the microphone, in this area there's a major land development proposed. Are you for it or against it?
I am not. I'm staying neutral on it so far. The gentleman basically has bought land, and there's nothing wrong against that. The reason why he's able to buy land is people just cannot afford to keep paying the high taxes and living here. The cost of living is way too much. We need to get it under control. I think the idea probably is as far-fetched as 2014 was back when it was written in the 1900s. But I can understand why the people feel like wanting to do this. I'm more concerned about the fact that he's considering it a nonprofit foundation. I think when I get into the legislature, that's one of the first things I'm going to approach is to handle that. I think we also need to realize that Act 250 has worked quite well to trim a lot of this kind of development. Unfortunately, there's a lot of flip-flop sometimes when enough money's speaking, and I would certainly not be one to allow that.
Sarah.
Sure. So I'm against the New Vista project as it's described by its proponent, and I don't think that that is the right type of development for our community. I think 20,000 people in this little town, I mean, you're looking out at these hills, and you wouldn't see that in 10, 15, 50 years if New Vista really came to fruition. I just don't see how we can, as a state or even as a community, look at this project and say it's going to bring jobs when the person who has put this project in its place and sort of described it has very clearly stated that this would be a closed economy, that all of the economic drivers inside and outside of the corporation and the entity would stay right up in its own little development. So I am against it.
Thank you both for your answers to that sort of quick round of questions. Coming up, each of you will get an opportunity to question the other. You will have 2 minutes to 30 seconds for the question, 2 minutes to respond. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're broadcasting live from Tunbridge World Fair, and it's political debate season. The last of our four debates we're in the middle of right now, which is the state representative debate right here in the local Tunbridge area between David Ainsworth and Sarah Buxton. The section that we're moving to right now is each of you get to ask each other a question. You have 30 seconds to ask the question and a minute and a half to answer the question. David, you're first.
Thank you, Mike. At the last election, the whole Democratic Party said, we hear you. We hear you. We're not going to do several things. We understand, and yet they turned around and reneged upon these promises. And I just don't not question whether or not we can believe when you keep flip-flopping on different issues all the time.
Sarah?
Well, I don't know what you're specifically referring to with flip-flopping, but I think probably what you're driving at is some of the financial concerns about the revenue package. I want to be clear, first and foremost, that when I sit as your legislator, I vote for my district and not for my party. There is a good example of when I did that this year, when I did not support the tax package that was put before us. I think I was one of maybe two Democrats who didn't support that. I think that we've done a really good job in the state of Vermont of trying to balance the needs of Vermonters with the way that we fund our services. There are a lot of Republicans right now who are talking about the types of taxes that have been generated in the last session. I'd like to just remind your listeners that the great majority of those taxes are taxes on things like out-of-state banks, out-of-state investment companies, and others, so that these aren't taxes that you and I as middle-income, low-income Vermonters are paying. These are fees and taxes that other folks are paying into our state, and it's helping us to do just what we need to do for our government.
Thank you, Sarah. Sarah, you now have the honor of questioning Mr. David.
Sure.
David Ainsworth.
David, Republicans in general, and perhaps you included, believe that government is too big and should be cut. What programs in particular would you cut, and how much money would that save?
David, you have a minute and a half.
I cannot give you specifics as to where to make the cuts, Sarah, because I have not been in the legislature for the last 6 years. However, I can do recall that when the current governor was senator, president of the Senate, they proceeded to constantly cut back within the ag agency and all the agencies. They had two or three lieutenants, deputy commissioners, and they forced the legislature into cutting them back. And the first thing that they did to step out when they started was, again, enlarge all of the agencies. All of a sudden had two or three deputies. Unfortunately, this requires paying down the road, and the money is not there except by continually increasing taxes. the issue, I'm afraid I froze up when it came to asking the question, and I'll reiterate, yes, I was talking about taxes. You went ahead and raised nearly $100 million in taxes in the last 2 years, and that's after the agriculture had its best year in 2014, and I actually myself was paying taxes into the state the first time I'd been able to do it for quite a few years. So this idea of we need to do this program, we need to do that program, it falls back upon the individuals paying taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Ainsworth. Sarah Buxton, you have 2 minutes for a closing statement.
Great. Thanks, Mike. In the last 6 years, I've been able to help make the state that we live, work, and play in more prosperous, more fair, and more promising. Today, we've talked about some of the good we've done while I've served in Montpelier and some of the work we have ahead of us. I know that I've got the skills, the fortitude, and the drive to make sure that Montpelier keeps making policies that will help people in towns like mine here in rural Vermont. I'm a fifth-generation Vermonter who grew up here and went through 20 years of education in this little state. At 38, I can proudly say that I've owned my own house for 5 years, and thanks to some scrupulous budgeting, have been slowly paying off the over $200,000 in student debt that I have. I balance two jobs and know firsthand what it is to work hard to try to get ahead. I know what it is like to check the balance in your checkbook before going grocery shopping, to delay an oil change until the next pay period, to change the belt in your own stinking dryer just to save a buck. This is the life experience and budgeting mindset that I bring on your behalf to Montpelier. When I speak for my constituents, when I cast my votes for my constituents, and when I advocate for my constituents, it comes from the heart. It's real, it's honest, and it's authentic. This has earned me the respect of my colleagues, especially when we don't agree. Because if there's one thing that democracy should stand for, it's the notion that each representative brings the genuine interests of their people to the floor, and every interest deserves to be heard. If folks listening today have liked what they've heard and think that someone like me deserves to be reelected to the legislature, I invite you to go to votebuxton.com and make a contribution to my campaign. As you can tell, David's a formidable opponent, and I need all the help I can get to win this race. To my constituents who are listening, thank you for the respect and the support that you've given me in the past. I look forward to talking about what matters to you when I come knocking on your doors this fall. And I hope that I can earn your support again this election. Thank you, and thanks, Mike.
David.
I must commend you, Sarah. Your certainly years in law school worked off excellent speaking ability. Unfortunately, I also remember the first time we campaigned and you said, I am not your representative. I am here to be your interpreter of what the state says needs to be done and bring this back to you, the people. Unfortunately, when you passed Act 46, I'm not sure how much you came back to the people and explained about the idea of losing school choice. I'm also concerned down the road about this coming back to explain the justification for carbon tax on the individuals that are trying to have to commute long distances to get the jobs or the second jobs or to try to pay the home heating fuel. Unfortunately, the situation of the almighty powers knowing what's best for you up in Montpelier doesn't really resonate very well with me. I'm at the other end. I get the regulations. I get to have to be accountable for what my actions are on the farm and in the neighborhood. And I just have a hard time believing that this can be done when you don't include both parties, when you don't listen to all sides of the arguments, when you sit down and say, this is the way it's going to be. You all voted out the idea of the local communities being able to have a say about renewable energy siting in their towns and neighborhoods. Yet at the same time, within a short time, the governor vetoed it after you guys made modifications for that law to his satisfaction, supposedly. And then you come back and you sustain his veto because you didn't have $300,000 in for town regional planning, and that's a pittance the way you handle money up in Montpelier.
Thank you, David Ainsworth. Thank you, Sarah Buxton, for a great debate. Thank you so much, and thank you to our sponsor at Champlain Valley Equipment. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550 broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Park.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.